You're listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast. For I Will Be With You. Daily reflections on recovery from the Bible.
Welcome to the For I Will Be With You podcast for the 12th week of the year, from March 18th to March 24th, covering Genesis 45:26 to Genesis 49:22, based on the book For I Will Be With You. I am Baruch, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'll be your host. So, where we are now in the story is that Joseph has revealed himself to his brothers, that he is indeed alive and that he is the viceroy of Egypt, and he wants to now tell his father that he is alive after all this time. So he sends his brothers back to the land of Israel to get him and bring the whole family down to Egypt. When the brothers come to their father and say, in Genesis 45:26, it says, "And they told him," meaning Jacob, "saying, Joseph is yet alive, and he is ruler over all the land of Egypt. And his heart fainted, for he believed them not." Jacob fainted. He couldn't believe them. Now, there's a question. Why doesn't he believe them? And I think the answer is pretty obvious. Because he's been lied to about this in the past. You know, and I think also it's maybe hard for Jacob to imagine, A, that his son is still alive after all this time, and B, that he has become basically the king of a foreign country, and the king of a foreign country that is a country of idol worshippers. I think this would be very disappointing for Jacob on some level. So, but I think that from a recovery perspective, this moment tells you something about the fate of a liar. Being a liar, once you've lied to people, they will have trouble believing you in the future. This is a very core concept in life, and certainly in recovery. And as addicts, we've probably been through this. You know, addictive behavior brings out dishonest behavior, which is the result of self-seeking and the control that the disease exerts over us. And so in recovery, we may have to work hard on rebuilding the trust of those we've lied to in the past. Jacob does come down to live with his son, with the whole family. The whole family goes down to the land of Egypt because there's no food anywhere else. Joseph has invited them, and it's arranged for them to live in a place called Goshen, which is a part of Egypt where the Israelites lived. So in Genesis 47:28, it says, "And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the days of Jacob, the years of his life, were 147 years." So in keeping with the long lifespans in the book of Genesis, Jacob is 130 years old when he moves down to Egypt, and he lives for the final 17 years of his life in Egypt. And what's interesting is that this is the way the phrasing says, Jacob lived in this land. And it's, why is it that the Bible will say at this point, at the age of 130, that Jacob finally gets to live? He's had a life of pain and struggle, certainly for the previous 20 something years. He's been in terrible grief over the fate of his favorite son, Joseph. And now he's finally at peace. He knew that his beloved son, Joseph, was alive and his family was all together. So in recovery, we could think of it like this. It's sort of a counterintuitive idea that the end of one's life in old age is living. Certainly, for many of us, drinking and using in our youth was, that's what it really meant to be alive, you know, to be to be out there doing stuff that wasn't healthy for us. To be old, that was terrible. But here we have the opposite. And I think another way to look at it is that in recovery, even a short period of serenity is worth a lot of time in addiction. You can grow and thrive in so many ways when we are sober and have worked a good program. And, you know, it's never too late to get started. You know, sometimes you see what we might call an old newcomer. There is a man in a meeting I go to, so interesting. He's probably about 70. He's been sober about 10 years. And he said, when he was in his 50s, he said, you know, it's just an amazing thing. He said, you know, I thought I'd just drink myself to death and by the time I was 60, and that seemed like a good enough plan to me. I mean, that was where he was in his life. He was just slowly drinking himself to death. And now he's been sober for 10 years, and his life is quite different. His life is, as he described it, fulfilling in ways that he never could have envisioned, including relationships with his adult children that he never had before, grandchildren, all kinds of things. So here he is. He's really sort of like Jacob. He's living, finally, in the final years of his life. Now, at the end of 17 years, it says in Genesis 47:29, "And the time drew near that Israel," that's the other name for Jacob must die. "And he called his son Joseph and said unto him, If now I have found favor in thy sight, pray, put, I pray thee, thy hand under my thigh, and deal kindly and truly with me. Bury me not, I pray thee, in Egypt." Jacob is asking his powerful son for a favor. He's doing more than asking for favor. He's insisting that his son swear, make a solemn oath, that he will not bury him in the land of Egypt. Now, Jacob had many reasons for this, one of which was that he was destined to be buried in Hebron, in the cave of Machpelah, with the other patriarchs. That was part of it, a pretty good reason. But also, he understood that in the land of Egypt, which was a land of idol worship, that his tomb and his corpse might become objects of idol worship, and to him this was a total anathema. Did not want to become part of an idolatrous religion. Now, so the question is, why doesn't he just say, his son, you know, please make arrangements for me to be buried in Hebron? You know, Joseph is really the most powerful person in Egypt. Can't he just say, you know, let's make the arrangements? No, he has his son swear an oath. So the question is, why? Why does Jacob make his son swear an oath? And the reason, one reason it's given, is that Jacob understood that Joseph would be under some pressure for sort of image reasons and political pressure to bury his father in Egypt. He was basically the number two, he was the most powerful man in Egypt after Pharaoh, and it wouldn't look right for him not to bury his father in Egypt. It's like a big slap in the face to Pharaoh. So by making Joseph swear an oath, he was ensuring that Joseph would not be swayed by these kind of considerations and bury him in Egypt. And this is similar to something that we may go through ourselves in recovery and in the program, where we have the right intention to do something. We mean well. We want to do the right thing. But somehow we can't quite do it. There's too much pressure. We want to be liked by people, whatever it is, and we end up taking the wrong path. So the example of Joseph here is that we should be ready to swear, to make an oath, make a vow of some kind, that we're going to do something no matter what, if it's the right thing to do. Now, in the Bible, as Jacob is on his deathbed, he summons people from his family for some final words and from some final blessings. And he asks Joseph to bring his two sons. Joseph has two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born in Egypt. And Jacob has them come to him. And in Genesis 48:5, Jacob says to his two grandsons, I mean, he says to Joseph, he says, "And now thy two sons," Joseph's two sons, "who were born unto thee in the land of Egypt, before I came unto thee into Egypt, are mine, Ephraim and Manasseh, even as Reuben and Shimon, shall be mine." So what's happening here is that Jacob is basically sort of promoting his grandchildren, essentially, to being like his own sons, which is not it's not a trivial thing, because he's Jacob. He is the patriarch of the Israelite nation. He is the patriarch of the Judeo-Christian tradition. So to be his son is a lot more important than being his grandson. Because if you're his son, you get a share of the inheritance of the nation of Israel. The grandsons do not, in a sense. So each of Jacob's sons becomes a tribe, one of the 12 tribes. So this is a really interesting moment. And so one thing, but what happens out of this, and if you read the Bible closely, you'll notice that there is no tribe of Joseph. Joseph sort of gets, what happens is because his sons become his sons of Jacob, they get to be tribes and Joseph doesn't. What's really happening here, one of the many things that's happening, is that according to biblical law, the oldest son gets a double portion in inheritance. So Joseph is also being promoted in a way. He's being given the double portion of the oldest son. Now, he is the older son of Jacob's wife, Rachel, so he in some ways is deserving of a double portion. But he's not Jacob's oldest son. That is somebody else. So there's a lot of stuff going on here. And, of course, another question is why? Why do these two men deserve this unbelievable privilege? And one of the answers that's brought down is that Ephraim and Manasseh were considered to be men of great righteousness and wisdom. They were very devout in their religion. They were very devoted to what we might call biblical law and tradition. Now, that the reason that's an interesting accomplishment for them is that they were born into one of the most cruel and depraved societies in the history of the world. So these two men, who were born into a place of incredible evil, nevertheless managed to grow up and become righteous men. Now, of course, this is a big tribute to their mother and father, but it's also a tribute to them as individuals. And Jacob understood this, and he was able to reward them. And another aspect of this is, if you look at Joseph's reaction to this is basically positive. He doesn't really say anything about it. He doesn't complain. Now, certainly, I think a lot of us might complain. I think issues of inheritance are sensitive. And it's funny, I know someone who's going through something sort of similar to this in real life, which is his parents have created what's called a generation-skipping trust, meaning that when his parents die, he will not get their money, but his children will. It's the same kind of situation. It's like, hey, what about me? But he doesn't complain, because it's not just that he's getting a double portion. He was also realizing that he gets to really live twice. He has, and I think that this is something that a sober person will understand. It's, you know, if your children can have success because of you, that's a great reward in life. You don't have to get the credit. You have to get the credit for everything in life. It's okay if someone else gets the credit. It's okay if your children can thrive in life because of you. Then in Genesis 49:22, Jacob says, "Joseph is a fruitful vine by a fountain. Its branches run over the wall." So he's giving... Jacob is giving, on his deathbed, Jacob gives Joseph a blessing before he dies. Compares Joseph to a fruitful vine whose branches run over the wall. And this is a metaphor for Joseph's remarkable ability to triumph spiritually and materially. in the harshest of environments. He's like a vine that grows over a wall. The wall being symbolic of the vast spiritual corruption of Egypt. And we too have faced such walls in our lives, whether they're emotional boundaries with friends and family that seem insurmountable, or the basic barrier that addiction and addictive behavior can create between us and other people. I mean, I can't think of a better symbol of addiction and its effect on your ability to deal with other people than a wall. It's like you built a wall around yourself. Not a good one. You're just walled off from the world. So Joseph can be sort of like our role model, someone who can raise himself up out of the pit, so to speak, and grow like a vine out into the world. And maybe this can be like us. We can grow spiritually like a vine out from the pit of addiction and out into the world. In Genesis 48:20, Jacob says, "May you be like Ephraim and Manasseh." This is a Jewish father's on the Sabbath blessed their sons by saying this: "May you be like Ephraim and Manasseh." And this is goes back to this idea that we should be like Ephraim and Manasseh, able to thrive spiritually even in the most depraved of conditions. And there's an important counterpoint to this, which we saw earlier in the story of Lot and Sodom, which is that not everybody can be like Joseph. Joseph was able to raise two sons in the corrupt and evil atmosphere of Egypt and have them become righteous men. Many of us, I would say most of us, probably couldn't do that. Joseph was unusual. He was an exceptional person, and he had the power of God with him to remain true to his faith despite being in a horrible place spiritually, the land of Egypt. We have to consider very carefully for ourselves if we're able to do this. So Joseph is a vine who grows up over the wall. We have to be careful in thinking about where we want to put ourselves. Most of us are influenced by our surroundings, and of course we can overcome our surroundings, but it can be difficult. And I knew a man in a meeting. He had some good recovery. He was a pretty dignified person, but his story was interesting. His father had run a bar, and he'd grown up in this bar. He spent his entire childhood in a bar, basically, and not surprisingly became an alcoholic. But he said, because his father's friends used to hang around the bar were like, one was named Animal, the other was called Ron the Roofer. It was like, these were, rough characters. He grew up among rough drunks in a bar. And that's like Ephraim and Manasseh. But somehow, he was able to turn his life around. Now, of course, he went through a period of heavy drinking. But it's a reminder that we have to be careful who we associate with in life and in recovery. So, just continuing on this theme, in 49:22, when Jacob calls Joseph a fruitful vine by a fountain, its branches run over the wall, he's reminding us that Joseph is this kind of. And one thought on this is that there's different kinds of people in people of faith, or in the Jewish religion, in particular in this example, that there's some who do better inside the community, and there are those who are able to go outside the community. And you have to know kind of who you are. We have this in recovery too. Some people are really good at being inside the program, helping with people, in recovery inside the program. And there are other people who are good to go outside into institutions or out into the world and do 12-step work. Not everybody is built for this. And it's sort of a balancing act. Like sometimes the people go outside, maybe they could be helped by being inside a little bit more. Sometimes the people who are inside, maybe they need to get out a little bit. The world could benefit from their wisdom. Everybody has to figure out their place, and it can change over time. But the secret is to know who you are. And this is, we should need to keep this in mind, you know, with the program's idea of working with others, is figure out the best way to work with others. Think about where you're going to do the most good and help yourself in your own recovery. So just one final note. I'd like to make a tiny little commercial if I can. If you like this podcast, I'd encourage you to get the book. This is all based on a book, For I'll Be With You, which is at forillbewithyou.com. And if you like the podcast, please consider reviewing it, writing a review, or sharing about it on social media. Very much appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast, daily reflections on recovery from the Bible. www.forillbewithyou.com